Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. And let's begin with an experiment. Think of something really disgusting.
Human feces, vomit, the bodies of dead animals, the bodies of dead animals that are in your food, stinky, smelly people, bad hygiene habits, dirty toilets. Is that enough? You feel sick enough?
Yes. Okay, that is pretty disgusting. And I'm sorry, I promise, I'm not trying to gross you out just for fun. There's a point here. I didn't actually show you any of those things. You didn't have to smell them or touch them or see them. But if you're like me, just thinking about them made you feel a little sick. That's the power of disgust. It's one of the most primal emotional responses, and it's so easy to elicit that I can make you feel queasy just with words. How is that even possible?
Disgust has that almost magical power to go beyond mere words and take you to another place, take you to a place of emotions, to a place of strong feelings, where you're conjuring up things that you desperately want to avoid. And the work I've been doing has been trying to provide a story to explain why all of those strange things are disgusting.
This is Valerie Curtis. She's a public health scientist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and she's part of a growing network of disgustologists, researchers who are pioneering a new science of revulsion, which turns out to be incredibly revealing. For instance, take relationships.
So when a relationship is good and strong, people are perfectly happy to share a toothbrush. But when a relationship starts to break down, it's, oh my God, his filthy shoes, his filthy socks again. Oh, the smellies. In fact, it's been shown by relationship counselors that this is one of the first signs of a problem in relationships. So disgust is part of this intimate relations that we have between individuals and how we negotiate our relationships between each other.
Valerie says disgust is like a light that you can shine into dirty corners, and it can help us understand things a lot better. Everything from how we vote to who we love. The only problem is, to do the research, you have to talk about things that most people don't even want to think about.
I think you have to be fairly strong-stomached. Probably the biggest outstanding issue in public health in the world today is the fact that something over a billion people still have no toilets. But yet, to try and recruit scientists to my team to work on the problem of how to get toilets to people has been a constant nightmare, because we have to face the fact that human wastes cause disease. But human wastes are contaminating, disgusting things. So people don't really want to talk about it, let alone do what some of my colleagues do, which is go down pit latrines and study the bacteria that live in them, for example. Very brave they are too, but the disgust you have to stomach to do that sort of work is powerful, visceral, and very, very hard to overcome.
You know, it's such a familiar emotion that I think this is going to seem like a stupid question, but what is disgust?
Well, it's like asking what is an emotion. And I think what we should start with is trying to understand why humans should behave in certain ways and not in others. So if you think about it, you have ancient ancestors, a long line of them going back, in fact, back to green slime, back to animals, back to simpler forms of ourselves. They all had to deal with the problem of parasites. Parasites try to hitch a ride in us. They try to make a living out of living on us and multiplying within us. And so every human being has to have strategies, and in fact, every animal has to have strategies to prevent that happening. It's very similar to fear. Every one of your ancient ancestors was probably frightened of predators. None of your ancient ancestors, when they saw a saber-toothed tiger, went, oh, what a sweet pussy, and went and petted them.
Well,
because they'd have been eaten, right?
Those who did died out.
Exactly. So those of our ancient ancestors who went around going, oh, boo, oh, vomit, there's some food left in that, let me eat it, What happened to them? They went extinct. So the fact is that our ancient ancestors were all squeamish. Your ancient ancestors and my ancient ancestors, and we've all inherited squeamishness from them. And that's disgust. It's a system in our brain that biases our behavior towards doing things that stopped us catching infectious diseases and getting infected by parasites.
So it's essentially hardwired, you know, it comes readily installed in us. And yet some kinds of disgust, especially with food, is so culturally specific. I mean, you know, people in one country will love Limburger cheese or fermented shark meat, and other people from other countries will recoil. But so if disgust is related to pathogen avoidance, shouldn't there be more uniformity in the kinds of things different cultures find disgusting?
Well, actually, amazingly, there is a huge amount of uniformity in what different cultures find disgusting. I always say disgust is theme and variations. There's a big theme that you find the same from in every culture that you look at. The same things occasion disgust. There's seven particular types of disgust.
Seven?
Seven, actually, that you find across cultures. So we find, first of all, products that come out of other people, things like poo, things like bus, things like vomit. We find poor hygiene disgusting. Sex is an area where we're particularly careful about who we mate with, and any signs of infection in a potential mate, somebody who doesn't look healthy, has got dirty hair, hasn't groomed themselves, might have parasites, might be spotty, we tend to find a little bit of a turnoff. Types of food and animals we find disgusting. So animals that vector disease, like cockroaches and rats, we tend to find disgusting, and foods that have gone off. We do also find other people who look strange disgusting. It's an unpleasant reality, but it's true. Studies have shown that people who look extremely obese or people who look extremely ill, very thin, for example, tend to elicit a certain degree of disgust. And then we're disgusted by things that have come into contact with other things that are disgusting. So if I take a bite out of a sandwich, put it down again, you don't want to touch it because it's come into contact with my saliva. That's six types of disgust. Those are all parasite avoidance disgusts. But then there's the seventh one, which is moral disgust. And that's not so much about parasites, but there's an interesting story as to why things that we find immoral are also things that we find disgusting.
So it sounds like disgust evolved as primarily a protective mechanism, but there's an unpleasant side to all of this that we haven't really talked about when disgust is applied to groups of people undeservedly. I mean, some of the worst genocides in the 20th century were fueled by the language of disgust, in part. Has the research given you a better sense of how disgust can lead to discrimination?
Yeah, it has given me a very clear insight into what's going on with discrimination. So disgust is deeply interwoven with discrimination. It's a sad fact that we are very careful about our interactions with other human beings, particularly other human beings who might be outsiders, because outsiders could be the carriers of novel pathogens, novel diseases that we haven't met before that might be particularly dangerous to us. So we are innately rather careful in our interactions with strangers, and the greater the degree of distance, the more likely we are to be able to be disgusted by them. So what happens is leaders are aware of this. They know that we have this rather dark tendency within us to disparage, dislike, and be disgusted by out-group, by the people who aren't part of our in-group. And they prey on this during election campaigns, for example. They prey on it to create divisions, to create factions, to create a sense of, if you vote for me, I will protect you, you're the insider, and I will drive away the outsider, by using the rhetoric of disgust, by using the rhetoric of disease. It is no accident that during times of elections, we hear about immigration far more. We hear about foreigners far more, because what leaders are doing is getting people to vote for them by stirring up hatred and disgust of outsiders.
It's so interesting what you're saying, because I guess I have always assumed that stereotyping was at the root of prejudice. But it sounds like you're saying it's in fact fueled by disgust.
There's lots of different sorts of prejudice, but there is a very strong part of our human psyche that we evolved, because we evolved in societies which were very small and clannish, where we favored in-group over out-group, and where it made sense from a disease prevention perspective to prefer people who didn't look like they were behaving oddly, because that might mean they had a disease, or because they looked strange, because it might mean that they had a disease. So humans do have a certain innate desire to be clannish and to avoid the different and the difficult. But that doesn't mean we have to listen to that nowadays. I think it's very important we recognize that that is part of our psyche and that we deal with it. So, for example, the human village now is a much bigger community than it was when we evolved. We actually know people from across the planet and interact with them very closely. They become our friends. They become our local community. And we recognize much greater variety of norm nowadays because we see so many more different types of people. So prejudice is breaking down. And the answer to it is more exposure to every type of human being that there is from our in-group and different to us, because we come to then recognize that as normal and we stop feeling disgust about it.
Valerie Curtis is the director of the Hygiene Center at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and she's the author of Don't Look, Don't Touch, Don't Eat, The Science Behind Revulsion.